Good day, Vashon Mori Island. My name is March Twisdale, and I'm so glad you've joined us today here at our island's own Voice of Vashon on 101.9 FM, KVSHLP Vashon. You're listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, a conversation-style interview show highlighting authors from around the world who seek in their own creative way to inspire all of us to be the best we can be. And now, on with the show. All right, so Melina, it has been many months since we first started chatting about this interview, but here we are. Thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And so your full name is Carmelina Marchetta, correct?
Correct. It's probably even more full than that, but I won't go into how long it is. So it's a very Italian Catholic extended name.
Oh, I love that. Okay, well, I mean, I think that's super cool. But yes, and for today, I'll be calling you Melina.
Yes.
Excellent. All right. So you're calling in from Australia. So this is so awesome. Ha ha. It's Sunday here and Monday there.
Yes.
I love it. The dateline. It's like time travel.
I know. It's always very strange, especially when you're traveling. I think you had mentioned it in an email, but I do remember missing out on my birthday once when I flew from the States back to Australia. It's the 25th of March, just disappeared.
Oh my goodness, you missed a day, and I was going the other direction. Yeah, I felt like I stopped time. I did the same day twice in a row.
I know, isn't that strange?
And it happened to be the winter solstice. So it went from the summer solstice, longest day of the year, and then I did the winter solstice. I was like, I just did both in a row. It was so mind-boggling. Huh? Okay, so let's see here. If you could just real quickly for our listeners, if you could ground them a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Okay. Well, I'm a writer. I live in Sydney. I'm mostly known for writing novels, but I have adapted one that was filmed and came out in the year 2000. And I also do have been working on, you know, TV scripts, and I've done a tiny bit of TV writing. I did teach for 10 years, and I've been pretty much writing full time since 2006, I think it is. So it's kind of interesting and scary sometimes to be a full time writer.
I imagine. Well, any person who is essentially an artist and self-employed.
Yes. You're always wondering, can I do this for another year? And then you realize you've been doing it, you know, for 14 years and you've managed it. So, but that's how I begin every financial year. Can I do this for another year?
Right, right. So now let's see here. The everyone who's listening in right now, they may or may not be familiar with your books, but so a couple of the names are Looking for Ollie Brandy, On the Jellicoe Road, Saving Francesca, Tell the Truth, Shame the Devil. All four of those are written from sort of what would be called the YA perspective. Is that true?
Looking for Ollie Brandy, Saving Francesca, and On the Jellicoe Road would be considered YA. And Tell the Truth, Shame the Devil, I had to ask where it fit, because I would have just called it crime fiction. Mm-hmm. But it was considered literary crime fiction. So
I was just mentioning to you earlier when we were doing the pre-chat about the Manuscript Academy, and she was also talking about, you know, where you were put on the shelf and how that affects your ability to reach a new audience and, genre limitations. So we're going to get into that as well. I was curious, though, because you did spend 10 years teaching. So I'm wondering how much your experience as an individual, meaning you in your own life, and then how much your experience from the perspective of a teacher in your state school, how much did that influence your writing?
Well, it's, if I had to go back, I left school when I was 15. I didn't do my last 2 years, which I think for you guys would be, you know, senior, like it's called here year 11 and 12.
Right.
And so I left school when I was 15, and I didn't go to university to be a teacher until I was 25. So I worked for during that time, worked in a bank, worked in travel. And it was during that time that I started writing my first novel. Mm-hmm. And so by the time I went to university, My novel came out in the second year of uni. And that was, you know, for me, I was writing about an age group that was close to the age group of the character. I think that by the time I started teaching, which was, you know, years later, it, you know, I hadn't written a novel. I feel as if I could win the Guinness Book of, you know, award for the longest time between first and second novel. They were 11 years apart. And right. I started teaching, and it wasn't until I started teaching a couple of years in that I thought, oh, gosh, I could write about, not that I could write about the place,
right.
but I come from a real girl's world. I grew up, you know, sisters, girl cousins. I went to an all-girls school, and there I was teaching at an all-boys school.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, oh, my God, it was so, I can't even begin to tell you. It just did my head in for so many reasons. First of all, because we just do think in different ways. And by the time I just got to see the absolute decency of boys, which I'm so glad that I had that opportunity mm-hmm. to find out just how amazingly decent boys could be, I thought I want to write about them, but I don't want to write from the point of view of an adult, and I can't from a girl, and because it was an all-boys school. But what was happening a lot in Sydney, for example, was that there were schools that only went to year 10, and you'd have to go to another school to do, you know, finish your schooling. Mm-hmm. And so I did one of those what ifs. What if my school, which was an all-boys school, took in girls for year 11 and 12? And that's what Saving Francesca ended mm-hmm. up being about. So I wasn't writing about me, but I was certainly writing about what it felt to be female, you know, one of 30 females or one of 10 females in an environment of 750, you know, males. And that's where that story started.
Mm-hmm. That's a rich premise to come from.
Yeah, and it was just, it was interesting because it was 11 years between, my first book was, you know, here it was quite massive, the response to it, just because of the diversity. You know, my family, as you can see by my name, you know, we're, you know, I come from an Italian family. And when I first started writing that novel, there was pretty much nothing about that experience of what it felt like being a second generation or a first generation Australian, really, but, you know, second generation Italian. And so that took off because there weren't many books exploring what it was like to come from a non-Anglo or non-Celtic, you know, background. But by the time I wrote Francesca, which was 11 years later, I just felt as if I could go into different areas. And although it was still a young girl with an Italian background, that was no longer the issue. The issue was the fact that she was in this all-boys environment, but also it deals with mental health because, you know, her mother doesn't get out of bed one morning. So it just kind of went into that whole idea of what it feels like to have a parent who's dealing with depression. And back in 2003, well, here anyway, no one was really talking about mental health. So once again, that novel took off because all of a sudden people felt that they were talking about mental health.
Right. Yeah. And so I'm curious because I don't know a ton about the publishing world in Australia, but I have definitely lurked around and listened to conversations. And I've looked for a few other writers to be on the show, actually. And in conversations with some of them, they've said there's, like, I've heard something along the lines of there's 12 agents in all of Australia. And I remember thinking this has to be wrong, but what is it like, the publishing world in Australia? Because I see Australia as this big, vibrant country with all these, you know, cities and amazing things. What's the publishing world like?
It's very vibrant. It's very, you know, there are probably that amount of publishing houses, but think of our population. It would probably fit the amount. My agent, however, is my literary agent is in New York. So it works to have someone who understands the Australian system, but also understands the international one.
Right.
And I'm sure that this is the same with the US as well, that you can either have an agent who finds a home, that's how they refer to it, or else you can try your luck. And, you know, sometimes a publishing company will have a submissions, or most publishing companies will have submissions on their website, and they will say, you know, we are accepting unsolicited manuscripts. And when I first started writing, and I mean, this was a long time ago, but I didn't have an agent, mm-hmm. and I was considered, mine was an unsolicited manuscript. It was back in the day where you typed. I remember typing out my manuscript on a typewriter, on a normal typewriter. And once computers came about, that was great, but you only had one copy. But I sent it into to a lot of publishing companies, and I got rejected over years. And finally, Penguin Books published it, but they always say that they found me on the slush pile, and that was what they referred to as the pile of manuscripts that came through the mail that didn't come through a pub, an agent.
Right, right.
And I didn't get an agent until my second novel, only because I hated talking about money, and I didn't really, I wanted someone else taking care of me in that area.
Right.
But for me these days, because I've got an agent, my agent will read the manuscript, we talk about it, and then she'll say, you know, this is, in Australia it's a given. I would always give it to Penguin first because they've published me for 30 years and I've had an amazing relationship with them. But in the US, we decide who would best fit this particular novel, and, you know, the journey begins. She starts submitting it, and sometimes it gets rejected. Other times it finds a home, and we take it from there.
Right, right, right. So, well, that's interesting. I mean, I think it's, yeah, it speaks to the power of the publishing world based in New York, but it's expanding in many places. At the same time, we have a pandemic, which means the virus can go all over the world. We also have, and you were speaking to this earlier, we also have this global community that if you take the time and have the opportunity to access it on the internet, you can reach out and connect in a way that that obviously never existed before in human history. So let's talk a little bit actually about the topic of the day that almost everyone talks about, which is how have you been impacted over the past 18 or 19 months now by the pandemic? For other writers out there, you know, what have you been finding hard or beneficial about the effect of the pandemic on your day-to-day life and that effect on your writing?
Well, you know, last year we had a strangely good year in, you know, when the US and Italy, I remember when it started, because it felt as if it started going badly first in Italy, when all of that was happening, you know, apart from the first couple of months of it when we went into lockdown, the good thing for me was so many of my projects were funded before we went into lockdown. Mm-hmm. I was working, we had received some funding for a particular film project based on Saving Francesca. We had another production company I was working with had received funding to, for me to write a pilot for, say, Jellico, and various things like that, as well as the fact as I was writing a little a chapter book series for, you know, early readers. That all got funded before I went into lockdown. So I pretty much spent the whole of the year working, and it was easy kind of work. When I say easy, it wasn't easy, but it was easy because I didn't have to think of what the story was about. The story was already there, and the hard part was, you know, working out how to structure it. And during that time,
well, I'll point out there that, you know, every person who's a writer and has a project in front of them has to go from the raw creative force that brings about the rough draft, and then the real writing, as some quotes out there will say, is in the rewriting. The thing is, I think it's really interesting that you mentioned the value of the existent funding, because for so many writers, they're spending months and years of their life investing tons of energy and time into a project that isn't yet, quote, funded. No one's bought it. No one's planning to publish it. And so I think that it sounds brilliant to me. I'm very happy that you spent last year investing your energy into projects that had already been invested in by others. And I think that's wonderful. I'm really glad that you had that going for you that year.
And I was too. I was very grateful for that, because it was just, as we all know, it was such a strange, awful year. And in the middle of that, I have a 9-year-old, and she is not an independent learner at all. So I was pretty much homeschooling. And I remember when we first went into lockdown, I think it was last March, that about a week in, and I'm homeschooling, I had no choice. We had been given this money for me to write a pilot on the Jellicoe Road. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is you get the producers call it, you get a room together, a room of, you know, script advisors and other writers to just kind of shape this story. And we ended up having to do that on Zoom. So every day I was Zooming from 9 to 4 o'clock.
Oh, my goodness. You know, that's a lot of hours.
Yeah. For 7 days. I remember the first time when it was supposed to be done with all of us in a room, I had to cancel it, and I felt so responsible. I felt awful, because what that meant was I was taking away an income for someone who had committed to that workshop, who needed that money. And I had to cancel it because we had just started homeschooling, and it was when everyone was really tearing their hair out. Those early mm-hmm. weeks, I mean, it's bad enough now, but those early weeks were, you know, what are we doing?
Right.
So we managed to postpone it for a week or two. And then when I got used to the idea that my daughter was going to be home with me, we started up this 7-day workshop with 5-minute breaks here and there. But we got it done. We got it done. And mm-hmm. And then what happened in Australia is life almost went a bit to normal. We got the numbers down. We thought we were just absolutely amazing. Melbourne suffered a bit because they had, you know, another breakout, and they went into lockdown again. But pretty much I would say, when I compare it to this year, last year was a breeze. Mm-hmm. And then we came into this year, and all the projects that I worked on last year, which were amazing, we were so happy with the outcome, the scripts and the pilots, we then had to send off because, you know, in Australia it's probably the same as US. You've got a producer, that's fantastic, and you've got funding from a funding body, that's fantastic, but at the end of the day you need a streamer or you need a network. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be 1,000 scripts and pilots out there, but if they don't find a streamer like Amazon or Netflix or HBO, then they won't get shown.
Are you saying that you actually had already filmed it and were looking for someone to stream it, or were you still looking for someone to actually produce and direct it?
No, we'd have a producer, we'd have directors, you know, in line. No, I would have had to write. I've written a film script for Saving Francesca and a pilot for on the Jellicoe Road, for example.
Right.
They don't get filmed. You then send all the producer. When I say you, it's the production company, but the producer will send, for example, the pilot and what's considered a TV Bible to a streamer, and then we wait for them to get back to us to say whether they're interested or not. So,
wow, that is a tremendous amount of investment prior to knowing that the final investor is interested.
Yes. And so last year was all the work, and this year, which has been the frustrating part, has been all the waiting. And for Jellicoe, for example, we had a major streamer come forward and say, we're interested in giving you development money. Now, that still isn't the same as being given the go-ahead of we're going to be commissioning this. Right. But development money means that we're going to probably end up back in a room again, on Zoom or in the real world, fleshing out what those episodes look like, and then I'll go off and write the episodes, and then they'll get resubmitted and they'll decide whether they want to commission. So the good and bad part of that is, the bad part is there's a lot of waiting, but the good is if someone has said, we are going to give you development money, it means I get paid. you know, at the end of the day, if I don't get paid, well, then I have to go out and get a paying job. So, you know, when I think of my life as a writer, some people, when I was teaching, I had this one income and it was a guaranteed income. You know, I knew it wasn't going to go away and I had this one job. Whereas when I chose to write full time, I realized I had to have about 10 jobs a year. Yeah. To make sure that I get that income, and it's been doable. You know, whether you are writing a piece for a newspaper or whether you are going to a literary festival or whether you're writing a speech for something or whether you are getting an advance, it's constant looking for work, but mm-hmm. I've managed to be able to, you know, make a living, which is important to me because I do want to write. That's kind of all I want to do sometimes. So.
Right. Well, and it's interesting, the backstory is always so much more than, you know, the consumer of the product usually has any idea. I mean, it can, like, I remember when I was younger, there was like a TV show that would show you how things were made. And like one of them was, how is a stick of gum made in a factory? You know, what are all the ingredients and how does it get laid out and chopped up and wrapped up in foil and thrown? I mean, every time I see any product at the store, I'm like, oh, I wonder what it looks like in the background when they're making this. But the same thing's true for artistic endeavors. And I interviewed the author of Dumplin', and it was made into a movie that Netflix offered up. And my impression was that that meant that Netflix had called up and said, hey, I want to option that book, make it into a show. And the author said, great, hand me some cash. And the agent said, great, or whatever. And then off Netflix went and da-da-da-da-da, did their thing. No, not at all the case. It was like this, you know, they put that thing together with like tissue paper and string and dental floss. And it was because Jennifer Aniston believes so strongly in the message, and it meant so much to her personally. She really pretty much was the driving force. And then eventually, as you're saying, after it was created, they shot it, I guess is the right word, in like 30 days and 1 month, the entire thing. But after that, then Netflix picked it up. So like, I was amazed. I thought, well, I just assumed Netflix was in control of the creation production process, and apparently no, Netflix is like, hi, we don't have to do that, you need us, so you go do all the work and then we'll just pick you up if you're good enough.
Yes, and it is like that. It's just anything that you see announced, you know, either it's going to be made or it's being given this money, it's never guaranteed. I always think, thank God it's my work that I'm adapting at the moment, because I wonder if I would have given up on certain things if it wasn't my work. But mm-hmm. because we're so close, like to be given development money is amazing from a major streamer. You know, with Saving Francesca, you know, what we're all sure of, and I know because I've written that script and I know what we've gone through with that script. You don't just have one person reading it. You, if someone's given you funding for it, like a funding body like Screen Australia, you have to go through so many drafts of someone saying, this isn't working, that isn't working. It's constant rewriting. All you mm-hmm. do all your life is rewriting. To the point that someone will ask me, what are you working on now? And I'll say, okay, Saving Francesca. And they'll say, haven't you been working on that forever? And I think, yes, that was the first draft. This is now the 10th draft.
Right.
But regardless of all of that, we all know that there is this beautiful script out there. But at the moment with Francesca, we're on a holding pattern because we're waiting for the right time to then pitch that. So that could seem frustrating, but you trust the process. And I right. think process is everything when it comes to writing. And so that's why last year was for me such a positive, because I felt, you know, I was writing until the 24th of December. I was writing so many different things last year, whereas this year, you know, everything feels as if it's waiting. And then, of course, mm-hmm. Australia or New South Wales, where I live, Sydney is in New South Wales. We've gone into lockdown and we've been in lockdown for 8 weeks. And mm-hmm. that's been really, really difficult because, you know, we can only walk with one other person. We can't have anyone in our homes. And I just for me, it's made me realize just how much of my creativity comes from being out there, from being part of a community,
right,
from listening to the conversations around you.
Well, there's a difference between, there's an interview from, I think, my first or second year of doing the show, so 2014 or 15. This incredible man, he's a Native American storyteller. And I ended up inviting him on the show, and I was like, do you want to do it over the phone? Do you want to come over to the island? And he was like, no, I don't want to do this over the phone. I definitely want to be in person. And one of the things he talked about was and this is, of course, ironic given the middle of the pandemic, we're all terrified of everyone else's breath. But, you know, he said, when we share breath, you know, when we're in the same room and we're sharing breath with one another, it is so fundamentally different. There is a difference. And it's sort of like when you're in a concert hall and a really amazing singer hits those notes where suddenly all the hair on your body stands up and the shivers race through you. And that, I've never had that happen listening to a CD.
No, and that doesn't mean that what you're listening to isn't great and amazing. It doesn't bring you pleasure. Of course it does.
Right.
But I think what it does to your soul I love that idea of sharing breath. My sharing breath comparison is I suppose it's coming from, you know, my background, which is Italian. And even though, you know, a lot of my friends aren't Italian, that whole idea of eating together, I always say that sharing bread, it's just where the conversations come out. It's it's where people reveal things, you know, that you wouldn't get if you were just, you know, even on the phone. And I've always even found, especially, it's interesting that I live in Sydney, which is considered, you know, a big city. But at the end of the day, I always say that Sydney's like a, you know, big country town, because you can go to your local supermarket and you have the most intense conversations with someone that you've bumped into in, you know, the aisles, and you can't do that anymore. So I think that for me, story has not disappeared by all means, but all those stories that I feel feed my writing and find their way in my stories, they've been kind of cut in half, and I'm relying on either my own intellect or, of course, I'm listening to podcasts and I'm, you know, watching movies and I'm reading, but it's just not the same as being out there. And even when I think of any, you know, exotic writing I've done, I've traveled for it. I mean, I've been in Turkey to research, you know, particular geographical landscapes and things like that, you know.
Right. Oh, I totally get it. Yeah.
Yeah, you just can't do that anymore, because there's a difference between looking up Google Earth and a difference between being there and smelling, you know, the stone and the texture and all of that. And I miss that so much.
I couldn't agree more. I've been working on my book series for a decade, a little bit over 10 years now. The beauty of allowing that 10-year period was that I had plenty of time and opportunity to sort of allow things to marinate and trickle in. But one of the things I did was I hit a block. I needed to understand my super uber bad guy. And until I understood him, I couldn't actually move forward on the story. I understood my other characters, but they needed to be in relationship with him and I needed to know him better. And so I actually had a chance to meet my mom in Europe. And I said, you know what? I'm going out 2 weeks earlier and I'm going to go to all these places that are in the first and the second book of my series. And I spent 2 weeks and it was so amazing. The notes, the feelings, the ambiances, and you're absolutely right. Google Earth is cool, but it is not the same as being there.
No, no, not at all. And I love what you said about the marinating and the trickling in, because I do feel as if you need that time. It's why I suppose I'm not saying that I don't understand that people can write, you know, three books in 1 year by all means. I you know, I think everyone has their own thing, but I just think allowing a book to settle or a story in your head to settle, I find that I discover so much more about my characters a year after inventing them. And, you know, you just need that time. But You know, I felt the same way, you know, when I was traveling, the first time I ever traveled for my book. And it was even interesting because I used to say to people, I'd be in Europe and I'd say, I know this is a bit indulgent, but I'm here to research, you know, something for a book. And then I stopped saying that because I thought business people don't go overseas and say, I know this is a bit indulgent, but I'm here for work. So I stopped kind of downgrading the fact that I was there, you know, that I was there for work. But I remember it was back in the day where GPSs were just coming about, and I had never driven on the other side of the road. You guys drive on the other side of the road. I had never done that. And I was in France and I had a GPS, and every day I would put in an address that was 3 hours away and I would drive to the most amazing places. And then I'd go home. Actually, it wasn't 3 hours away. It would be an hour away from where I was. And I would go home and I could not stop writing for the rest of the afternoon. It was almost like I'd go out there with a blank slate of a head and come back with so much.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. And as I said, it's what I miss the most about writing at the moment. I don't have that opportunity.
Right.
And gosh, I can never complain about this. I'm living with my elderly mum at the moment and my daughter, but at the moment, I'm someone's daughter and I'm someone's mother.
Yeah.
And I feel as if I was saying to someone yesterday very dramatically, it's like I don't know who I am anymore. But for the time being, I want to be those two things because I need to get them through this pandemic. You know, you do kind of put yourself, you know,
aside.
But I can't wait. I can't wait for the story to come back into my life, into my head, and that feeling of I can't stop writing. And I feel as if that's the negative of the pandemic, you know, getting back to your question.
Right.
And the positive is just really, I mean, I never thought I'd end up in, you know, my childhood home with my mum, but just, you know, just the life that my daughter's having at the moment, you know, living with my mother and the life that we have together, I just think is wonderful. And she will remember this as a positive rather than a negative. And that for me is really important.
Right. Absolutely. I know it's, I think it's interesting when you're younger, the life ahead of you, some people can feel trapped, but for me, I moved a lot as a kid, so I never felt trapped. I always felt like I could pick up and move, pick up and start over. I mean, I moved a lot as a kid. So what's interesting is that now, you know, I'm in my, well, I'm 48 and my kids, thank goodness, you know, are doing great. You know, they're doing everything you should be doing when you're, you know, in your late teens, early 20s. And, but, you know, my mom lives with us and we've got like 3.5 more years to pay off the mortgage. My husband's a little older than I am. He's going to be retiring soon. And it's interesting because I feel like there's now, I don't feel stuck. But I feel like it's not quite as easy to just sort of move around or pick up and go do something new. There's these pieces of my life and I start to realize, oh, this is natural to this stage of life. How many, suddenly, you know, 15 years ago, I had friends who were older than me who would talk about how they were dealing with, you know, their mom or their dad who was getting a little bit older, or maybe a parent had passed, you know. And then in 2018, when I was in Australia, ironically, you know, my dad died. And, you know, now my mom's living with me. And it's like, suddenly you go, oh my gosh, I'm that person.
Yeah.
And then you're like, it changes the context of how you look at it, which ironically is exactly what goes into story creation. You know, I think a lot of times when people write, they're writing because there was an inciting incident in their own life. There was something that affected them authentically and deeply, and writing about it, you know, is the next step for them if they're a writer. So, or if you're a singer, you sing about it, right? So I wonder what the pandemic is going to, what's going to happen in the next 5 to 7 years in the world of publishing. What stories are going to come out of the people who have been through this experience? I mean, that's a very interesting question.
I think it's a very interesting one because I hope that all the stories aren't just going to be about a pandemic.
Right.
But, you know, even you told me a bit about where you live and I mean, just our earlier conversation off air, I was thinking, oh my God, that'd make such an amazing story. I think you were saying, you know, about if something happens, you're 3 weeks behind of getting help or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that our stories will be, I don't think they'll be about isolation at all, but I mean, imagine, I think for me, think of all the things that people have been doing that they hadn't done for a long time. And I, if mm-hmm. you saw this area yesterday morning, because it was, you know, Sunday morning and the sun's out, I have never seen so many people walking. So I just, we've discovered parts of our neighborhood, and we've, I mean, we've known this area for, you know, over 50 years, and we've found parts of it that we've never seen before. Right. So as walkers, you know, so much has come out of it. So I think that, I think interesting things will come out of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I hope we don't remember it for the negatives. And in, I mean, right. the hardest thing, of course, is we'll remember it because of the deaths. And I don't think, you know, any place can ever get over that. But I just, I'd like to think that it brought the best out of the people I love. I know it's brought the worst out of people. You know, when I read what people have got to say on social media and the whole thing, I think, gosh, wow, I'd hate to be in your head. But
right, right, yeah.
I feel as if most people have made do with what they've got at the moment, and it's been lovely, and I think that that's what our stories are going to be about.
The reality is human beings haven't thrived and survived on this planet by refusing to see that silver lining, by not taking away the good from the bad. We have all these sayings for a reason.
I feel, look, because we question this all the time, I feel as if we'll hold on to a lot of the good. I, of course, everyone's going to get caught back into, you know, the rat race if we're able to, but I still feel that that connection that we have with, that we've made with people, I think that that will continue. I don't know. So in a couple of weeks, we're going to be allowed to be out on picnics with five people.
Oh, my goodness.
And you know what? I know this city, and I know that every second person will be out there picnicking. Like, I just think what a lovely thing to have, you know, to reintroduce. I mean, we do it all the time because, mm-hmm. you know, when you've got small kids, but it's people my age that are saying, okay, here's the five of us and this is what we can do. But I just think we've found a different way of communicating. And mm-hmm. I don't know whether that's going to help my current writer's block. But I think I do believe that when this, you know, when we do have the freedom, you know, my head will be open to the possibilities. But it's hard for me because I have written back to back, apart from that first, you know, how I said that I hadn't written for 11 years, my first and second novel. Right. Ever since that, I have written something, you know, but I haven't even had a break. It's been, you know, continually writing. It usually takes me about, you know, 18 months to 2 years. Mm-hmm. But I've just always had stories in my head, and I feel as if this year has been the first time that I've thought, okay, what am I going to write about next? And I've always been one of those people as a writer where I always say the character comes calling. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, a character hasn't come calling, and I have to blame it on the pandemic.
Well, you're writing. So let's actually dive into this a bit, because I'm really curious. I don't even know if you necessarily have the answer either. So feel free to be like, I don't know. But we were talking earlier about how interesting it is that even though the UK and Australia and New Zealand and the United States of America and speak English and have like this original shared root, our histories are really, really super, super different. And every once in a while, those differences will like jump up and bite you in the butt, you know, or slap you in the face or just get your attention. And so I found when I was reading On the Jellicoe Road, I was really startled initially by what a lot of people in my country would be familiar with through the Harry Potter series, which is the idea of these sort of boarding school environments, and you have different houses And there's a level of sort of competitiveness. And I know in Jellicoe, it wasn't just the houses, but there was also like a, it was almost like there was the townies, I think. And there, and then there was the soldiers who would show, there's a word for it. I'm getting it wrong. But my point is that there was a level of infighting or competitiveness that seemed to be normative in the view of the characters, while for me, my jaw kept hitting the table and I kept scratching my head and being startled. And so I'm curious what, because you also spoke of working at an all-boys school and the incredible amazingness of boys. And so I'm wondering, can you, for an American reader who's going to pick up on the Jellicoe Road, or who might check it out when Netflix does pick it up or someone picks it up, what is that about? And are the schools that challenging?
They're actually not. So I have to say that with On the Jellicoe Road, when I was growing up, I just had a love of boarding school stories, and mostly the English ones, you know, like the Enid Blyton, you know, the Naughtiest Girl books, and anything where anything set in a boarding school would be the most exciting thing in the world. Here, boarding schools were either private and it was a distance away. So you would go to boarding school if you were in the country and, you know, your family wanted to send you to, you know, a boarding school. Private.
Right, right. When I was in Australia, one of the conversations I had was where someone was explaining that for some people who live really, really, really far out in the bush or whatever it would be called, that you can't literally drive your children back and forth to school every day. And so that they either you ended up homeschooling the kids out in the country, or they would go to boarding school because that was, they would just live too far away.
And it could be because there's a distance between, you know, your home and the local school, or else you might think the local school is good enough. So that's quite often. But Jellicoe came from this great love of boarding school stories and was written before Harry Potter. I have a lot of people, friends who come from the country, and I remember they would tell me stories about how they didn't get on with the kids of the town. And, you know, someone told me once that the kids of the town used to kind of, you know, climb into their school at night and do things. Mm. And my friends once kind of lined up the driveway with spikes so that when these town kids drove up, you know, it ruined their tires and all of these stories.
Oh, my goodness. So
it was kind of listening to those stories. But I did do like what I always do, what if, you know, what if there was a territorial war between this very isolated boarding school where a lot of the kids are made up of state wards and with the townies? And what about if once a year a bunch of cadets from the city, you know, set up camp near them and there's this territorial war between them?
And it happens every year.
But that is total fiction. That was total fiction. But what I wanted deep down was a personal story. I mean, what happens if, you know, when she's 9 years old, her mother drives her out to this remote area, and while she's in the bathroom at the 7-Eleven, her mother drives away. Right. You know, what's that story? Ultimately, I think as a storyteller, you always, you know, it's that story A, story B. It seems as if it's a story about the territory wars between these three factions. And, of course, you know, you find out that there's a bit of a romantic history between the leader of one and the leader of the other, so you're setting that up. So at the end of the day, what I wanted to do was explore what her story is.
Right.
And everything always has to fall into place together. So, you know, she's part of this territory war. She thinks about why her mother did what she did. And certain things have happened in that territory, you know, with her, where she starts realizing that somehow there's a connection between her and a bunch of kids who lived in that area, you know, 18 years ago. Every single thing that you've been told at the beginning that you think is totally irrelevant are the pieces that she needs to work out what her story is. So
yeah, it's actually really At the end, you're like, oh, I mean, in not expecting that, which I love. I've learned that if I'm watching a movie for the first time with a friend, it's really better for me to keep my mouth shut because otherwise I'm like, oh, he's totally blah blah, and my friend will look at me and almost always end up being right, and then it's like I'm just sort of like the spoiler girl. Okay, I'll keep my mouth shut.
I think
I'll
that
eat
a good,
popcorn instead of spoiling everything.
I know, because I am the same, but I think for me, if I'm watching something and I've worked out who it is or what's going to happen, I don't care. I just think, how are they going to reveal it? And
Right.
that to me is the power of great writing. I, when someone has said to me before, oh, I worked out, or you read a review of your book that's, negative, I worked this out. And I think, yes, but to me, it was never a mystery, you working that out. What I would like to think is powerful is how that information is given to you. And I think that that is, for me, when I'm watching something or reading something, that's what I'm waiting for, that emotional punch of that revelation. With Jellicoe, I think there's so much of that at the end, and it's interesting because, and we were talking about before the interview, we were talking about genre.
I was gonna say we need to get into genre because we're gonna run out of time.
Well, I was so well known for writing this realistic book about what it felt like to be, a daughter of a migrant, in Sydney. And it's something that was not really ever spoken about in our literature. And, this book, my first book, was so well received and still is after all these years. Because of that, it's considered a, an Australian classic because it was exploring that idea of the other, which we talk about today. And my second novel, the one that I was saying that was set in the boys' school, it was still set in Sydney. It was still about a, I'd say a normal family, and so considered realism. And then I write this third one where everyone who had loved the first two were, what is this? What? And I always say this, and it was disappointing, but I'm glad that, it's changed. But I feel as if the reaction here in Australia to that third novel, to Jellicoe, was, oh, no, we want her to write about, I always say, that little Italian girl in the suburbs. Not quite that, but they really wanted me to stay in that place. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to write my boarding school, story. And although
But when
it's,
you wrote that, it wasn't like, hi, declaration to the world. This is the sum total of what I can write about.
exactly, but sometimes you're forced into what someone else believes you can do. And really, it wasn't until it won the Prince Award in the US that Jellicoe, I felt, got that recognition that I was really hoping for. But I'm very stubborn, so when someone says we want you to do the same thing again, especially when Jellicoe came and that was their response, well, my response for the fourth book was to write a fantasy. So it's kind of like, don't put me in a,
In a genre box.
because at the end of the day, and I say this all the time, so my genre, so my fantasy book, Finnegan, is, set in a kind of a medieval looking world. It's about this young man who 10 years ago, his kingdom was cursed and all of these things, right? And he has never been able to return, him and half the people in his kingdom have never been able to return. And it's about, trying to gather his people to be able to find them a place. But at the end of the day, that book is no different thematically to my first novel, which is about being the child of a migrant, of being raised in a country that was not considered, the motherland, and what it feels like to be part of, I'm not going to use the word diaspora, but we are, I always say with Australia, which is what makes Australia so wonderful, is no one really, like we have an identity problem, which is a good thing because the indigenous people, they had this land taken from them. The children of migrants like mine, we've always been told we don't belong here. And the settlers or the Anglo or Celtic have always been told you stole this land. So none of us have really been allowed to completely take control of this space. So I find that whether I'm writing fantasy, young adult, or adult crime, whatever, I am always exploring that concept of identity and where is our place.
Well, there's that idea that you hear a lot of agents and a lot of people who write, offer advice to writers. One thing that they'll say oftentimes is there's no brand new story. Every story has been written. But
exactly.
How can you write that story that is so incredibly powerful, meaningful, and necessary for people to walk that path? How can you write that in a way that's, you know, new and fresh and interesting? So, I mean, yes, if you look at sci-fi and you look at fantasy and you look at dystopia in particular, it's basically, you know, Star Wars, same story written over and over in a million different ways, oftentimes.
Yeah.
And that does not negate the value, because these stories are the, oh, what's the word for it? They are the, oh,
I feel, you know, because what you were saying about
humanity expressed.
Yeah. And it's like, I've always been, you know, it's obvious. Our stories come from three different sources: the Bible, mythology, and Shakespeare. And we could kind of place most stories into one of those categories. And for me, ultimately, it's who your characters are and what you take away from them that make it individual. And
yeah,
it is about the placement of these characters. So when I talk about Taylor Markham in Jellicoe Road, I take away her history because I dump her on this road and her mother drives off.
Mm-hmm.
In Looking for Alibrundi, the first novel, this, you know, child of a migrant, she's also illegitimate back in the 80s where it's a really big deal in her community. Instead of sending her to my local school where she would have ruled, I sent her to the other side of the city where she is out of place. And with mm-hmm. Finnegan of the fantasy novel, I take his whole kingdom away. So it's about constantly doing these cruel things to your characters and then seeing, okay, what are they going to do now? Where am I going to go with these characters? And that's what I'm constantly trying to do, I suppose, as a writer. These characters come calling and I think, okay, let me work out whether your story is worth telling, and then let me start shaping it from there.
Right, right. Absolutely. Yeah, there's custodianship, or there's an incredible responsibility when you are creating the story. You're responsible to your readers, you're responsible to yourself, you're responsible to your team, and you're responsible to your characters.
Yep, and I always think, I always say this, that most of my stories also, the book at the back of my head that I grew up adoring was Anne of Green Gables.
Oh, me too. Read a million times.
I know. I just love it, love it. But there's always a moment, I feel, in a novel where metaphorically, you know, someone hits someone over the head with a slate like Anne did to Gilbert. And for me, that's such a defining moment in the story. First of all, because we fall in love with these characters, but also it is a kind of a wake-up call to something's going to happen. And,
yeah,
you know, I feel as if so many of my childhood stories, and that's another thing that I find so difficult about lockdown. Last year, I read a lot more. This year, I think this year alone, I've only read about 8 books. And I don't think that's a lot for, you know, someone mm-hmm. who's used to it. And I just think it's through other people's stories as well that you don't steal ideas, but you go, oh, you know what? There's just something about that moment that has mm-hmm. triggered off something. So I think I'll just welcome that time when I'm not doing year 4 mathematics with my child.
Right. yes,
I am. Yeah. Myself on the back, because I know what an acute angle is, that I will be able to write something very profound.
Well, Melina Marchetta, it is such a bummer we are running out of time, and I am so grateful to you for taking your Monday morning and sharing it with myself and all of our listeners here. So it just, wow.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure to speak about something, you know, so important to me as well. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you have, well, actually, I'm looking at it here. I'm going to tell everybody. All right. Well, oh, it's a bit long. So you can go to marchtwisdale.com and hear Melina's interview. It's under my podcast. And the thing is that there'll be a bio there. And the bio is going to have a link to her website, which is sort of long, melinamarchetta.wordpress.com. But it's also going to be there in the bio at marchtwisdale.com. And Melina, thank you. Just, I cannot wait to read the Lumetaire Chronicles, to be honest. Really exciting. I mean, I just, you were talking about it, but I also had previously browsed sort of the, you know, the bio about the book or whatever. And I love, by the way, the image that you have, the Finnegan of the Rock. It's got the young boy and there's this beautiful curly cue blue and black tree design. That's amazing. I noticed that when I went to Amazon, which for me is going to be the USA version of Amazon, they had a completely different cover. So
That is a conversation about covers is a complete another 1 hour of our lives.
Which yes. I think next time. Well, next time. But I don't know. I may chase you down for that beautiful cover copy because it's so beautiful.
I'll send you the trilogy, the original images of the trilogy.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I will take pictures and put them on Instagram.
Thank you so much for this.
All right, Melina. Hey, hang in there. Stay healthy. Glad that your daughter and your mom are healthy. And we're going to all get through this together.
I know we will. Okay, take care.
I will. You too.